Thank you, worship group. Thank you so much. You guys, beautiful. Yeah. I hurt my back a few days ago, so I'm not on my game right now. I may not be working the room like I usually do. So, but I do have cool new shoes, and I hate to see that. Yeah, I hate to see that go unnoticed. So I may find my way out there. If the deacons would just be ready to rescue me if I can't get back up on the stage. Boy, we're like a full room. Thank you, Thanksgiving relatives, for... There's about nine of us here in second service, so this is all different. This is great. Open Door doesn't travel well, so we're not helping out other churches, but other churches are helping us. And that's... Thank you. Well, we are I guess I need to get on with it here. We are in a five-week series, as you know. Last week we did gratefulness, and I would love to hear from you how that affected your Thanksgiving day. So if we just go one by one, just that's sure. And then today I'm going to be speaking on traditions, and then next week Jason's going to talk on facing the chaos that can come with a season, and then David Pinkerton's going to talk on strengthening, healing, discovering relationships in this season. Then I'll come back the fifth week with intimacy with Jesus in this season, and then December 25th is Sunday morning, and so we're going to be here. We're going to have worship. Matt Hoskins will be leading worship. We're going to have a sharing time. All the family will be in here together, and maybe a little teaching, and mostly it'll be a pretty short service, but Jason Ellis will be serving in the back buttermilk bars. So I don't know. Forget the draw of Christmas. We're going for buttermilk bars to get you here. Hey, open to a place. What I want you to do is put your portico or some kind of paper to make some kind of division and open to Leviticus chapter 23. And some of you are thinking, oh, I knew I should have gone to a different church today. Leviticus chapter 23. And then once you found a spot there, go over to Deuteronomy chapter 16. And I'm going to want you to, that's where we're going to be really centering. There'll be another passage that we'll go to. But Deuteronomy chapter 23, Leviticus chapter 23 and Deuteronomy chapter 16. So I told you last week that up until my early 50s, I didn't enjoy Thanksgiving. But what I left out was I really love Thanksgiving now. I have a great family with the Martins, and we have a beautiful time together. And what else has caused me to enjoy it is about 5-6 years ago, Carly and I went on a walk on Thanksgiving Day. And in the middle of that walk, we pulled some fruit off neighbors' trees, some grapefruit. And in some countries they call that theft. But we started rolling, and we created a competition of rolling grapefruit against each other, like who could get closest to the right rear tire on that car. And it was so fun. We just went through neighborhoods for miles and miles and couldn't stop. And she ended up beating me at a sudden death as we got home. And I loved it so much that I wanted it to happen the next year. So then Caleb was invited. And from that point on, it's been basically the Caleb Lynch citrus roll invitational. He always wins by a lot, and we're just pretty much just filler. We're like the Washington Generals for the Harlem Globetrotters is what we are. But we've been doing it for 6 years now, and we take fruit from innocent neighbors along the way. This year, Louise just said, use my fruit and take it, so she was a great starting point. But it's so fun. And this year, the highlight was, along the way, we weaved our path in such a way that we would end up at the Ellis's for their first inaugural citrus roll contest. And so their whole clan was out front chanting to us as we came up, citrus roll, citrus roll. And I handed to Nora the initial piece of fruit to start their tradition. And I just hope it spreads like wildfire. that eventually the turkey would be phased out. And I have this, I've told my kids, I said, on my deathbed, I want one of you to rush in and say, Dad, it happened. Today it's Thanksgiving. I know you're dying, but today, all over the world, people are rolling fruit. And they've changed the name of the holiday to Citrice. Then I will go with my fathers before me and happily. The reason I tell that is I did not prepare anything for you today. Is it because it is everything that this message is about? For as long as I can remember, whenever something transcendent or magical happened when I was a kid, I would step back from it, even sometimes while it was going on, and I guess because I'm a romantic, is I wanted to some way make sure that it happened again, that we would get to experience that again, or that it could be bigger, or it could be wonderful, because I wanted to share it with these friends and this event. I didn't want it to go away. There was something incredible in the event, whether it was playing baseball on a Saturday and then laying down as the sun was setting before all of us had to go in for dinner and the doors closed and we would just lay there and talk and laugh. I wanted that to happen again. Or when my brother and I made a high jump pit in the backyard and we had friends over and we play all day and have these contests of that and jump the river. Or when we had dug a tunnel under my dog's house and we were looking like for passageways to the Orient if we just dug deep enough, you know. So just being with Dave Barrows. And Dave Barrows and I hitchhiked out to what was then Chavez Ravine to see Sandy Koufax pitch. And I invariably would get down to us saying, okay, so you guys, listen, let's make a promise. We do this every year, no matter what. Okay? Promise even if, Bobby, if you move, even then, it doesn't matter. We find a way to get on a plane or something, and we get back here, and we do this again every single year for the rest of your life. You promise? Swear on a stack of Bibles? We always swore on a stack of Bibles. One Bible was never enough. You had to have like a whole stack for it to be official. And we say, oh yeah, I swore on a stack of Bibles, man. We're going to do this. And maybe they'd last for the next year. None of them made it out of my childhood. None of those things that I thought we could replicate all the rest of our lives. I became blood brothers before they knew about the transmission of through fluids, that I became blood brothers with Jeff Ketchum. At the time, we thought, man, this all of us are going to we're going to be blood brothers. I have no idea where Jeff Ketchum is. I'm not blood related to my wife, but Jeff Ketchum somewhere in the world is related to me by blood. So not all of these things worked. But they revealed in me this longing for a life more transcendent, eternal, bigger, more real, wonderful than the mundane existence. And I've never gotten past it. Many of us have never gotten past it. And then once I was invaded with the love of Jesus, I realized the source and the goal of every event I attempted to commemorate or immortalize. That hunger in me to memorialize or try to recreate or repeat or consecrate wonderful times with trusted friends and that sense of the transcendent, that was put in me by God. And the best traditions are usually mostly a pretext for something much, much bigger. See, how would you do it if you were God? How would you ensure that anything your creatures experienced of sacred value, how would you ensure that it would continue from the moment of its inception, spreading to those they love and then on to the generation after? Well, the answer was, I will create for them, I will model for them, I will initiate, I will institute for them traditions. And so he's built it into our longings, even long before we're believers. A longing to repeat events, holy or playful, that will remind us of something larger, more wonderful that has taken place in us. And to stop and drink it in and take it in and call it what it is. And not miss it in the midst of pain and confusion and things that don't tie as threads. To create something that we would so much want to not risk losing. Tradition, ritual, practice, custom, habit, an intentional, reoccurring gathering. I love that it matters to God and that He instituted it. That in the very doing of them, it would reenact magic. It would create cords of commitment and love. And it would protect us against running. When things don't make sense, when I get hurt, when I get confused, when I get frightened, or when I get lost in my own failure. It is the repetition that transfers ownership from one group to the next and ensures continuity of a way of life, of a heritage, of something beautiful that is worth keeping. You know what I realize now at 58? The healthiest communities, the healthiest families are always creating new traditions, or else they're eagerly honoring ones that they've stumbled into. They get it. And they live in meaningful contexts of tradition. There's no magic to it. There's no right one. It doesn't have to be elegant. It doesn't have to be expensive. It doesn't have to be well thought out. It is just simply saying, I love these people. And I love the relationship that God has with us. How do I find those threads that will allow us to continue to experience that has been beautiful to me? All tradition has behind its pretext this God-infused intention. You're given a benign excuse to strengthen bonds of friendship. You get to encourage others to live the life they wanted to, but maybe didn't know how. You learn together how to nurture the life you always wanted. You, in doing it, you fall more deeply in love with the Creator behind the event. And your joy increases. You're going to see that throughout these passages. Your joy wildly increases, and when your joy increases, your hope increases. God creates threads, fibers in such a community that turn into garments that can be worn, that protect you from leaving when things go off the tracks, that protect you from isolation and hiddenness and despair. And your heart is made softer and more humble, more yielded. And your hope of the eternal is given greater context and content. And you find yourself, you discover yourself expressing more naturally and beautifully gratitude. It's interesting, when we look at Leviticus and Deuteronomy, my first thought is, when I come to those, is how hard life was under the law. It was not a cakewalk in the Old Testament. There was just always so many things, because remember what the goal was, I'm going to give you this minutia because you say you can do it. I want you to grow weary and tired of your ability to please me, to be good enough to be able to try to figure out how to assuage your shame. So life in the Old Testament was hard. I mean, you were out of commissions for 2 weeks if you had mold in your wall. I mean, how'd they ever have little league teams? I mean, Reuben can't play third today. His family's ceremonially unclean. Deborah touched a dead winged cormorant, so she's out for the next three games. Sam's going to miss today because he walked across the path of an animal with a cloven hoof. How do you field a team out of that? How do you get nine players on a team? But even in this season designed to exhaust every ounce of self-centered confidence until they were ruined to their arrogance so that they would call out for a Messiah, God was there, revealing what God will always be like with his people. Revealing such a beautiful life, more beautiful than life under any pretend God. See, he had to bring them to an end of themselves, but he also wanted to bring them to the beginning of him. So God instituted, taught, modeled, built in, reoccurring celebration. You don't think about this, I don't think, when you think of the Old Testament, but much of their year was spent in play, in celebration, in feast, in playing and feasting and resting and laughing and strolling with no work the next day or the day after that. So here's Moses in the Pentateuch. He's got five books where, especially in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, he's giving instructions. You are about to leave this period of time, this 40 years of wandering, and you're about to go into the promised land. And there's some things that I want you to institute so that you'll never forget. There's some things that I want you to do when you get there that will protect you. I won't be going with you. Joshua, the son of Nun, he will be going with you. And so what we're looking at here is one especially, of these week-long celebrations. There were other festivals, daily occurrences, delight and ceremony and just wonder and playfulness. But within a 52-week, there were 3 weeks where the whole week was devoted to celebration. And so one of them was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, one was the Feast of Weeks, and then there was one that was called the Feast of Tabernacles, better known as the Feast of Booths. I'm pronouncing it better now because the other night Tom was listening to me explain the message to him, and he said, "Did you say the Feast of Booths?" I said, no, it's... he knew it. He went, "Man, I haven't heard of that one." I mean, was that in the Apocrypha or somewhere in there? But the Feast of Booths. So read along with me in Leviticus. Oh, I love that God instituted this. Chapter 23, verses 39. Start there. On exactly the 15th day of the seventh month when you've gathered the crops of the land, after you've worked hard together, all of this would be every year, right, this will come right after you've harvested the wine, you've brought in the wine, you've brought in all of your, all of the crops, all the vegetables, all the fruit. You shall celebrate the feast of the Lord for 7 days, with a rest on the first day and a rest on the eighth day. Now, on the first day, you shall take for yourselves the foliage of beautiful trees and palm branches and boughs of leafy trees and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. You shall celebrate it as a feast to the Lord for 7 days in a year. It shall be a perpetual statute. Come on, you guys. We're going to do it every year. Promise on a stack of Bibles? Throughout your generations, and you shall celebrate it in the seventh month, and you shall live in booths for 7 days. All the native born in Israel shall live in booths, so that your generations may know that I had the sons of Israel live in the booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. There's the pretext. I want you to remember, I want you to be able to tell your kids that you lived in tents for a long time, 40 years, but I was faithful to you when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And here's what I want them to get. I want them to experience that I am the Lord your God. Go over to Deuteronomy 16. And look at verse 13. It adds a little bit more flavor to it. He says, "You shall celebrate the Feast of Booths 7 days after you have gathered in from your threshing floor and from your wine vat, and you shall rejoice. You see that word over and over again in your feast, and you and everybody you know, your son and your daughter and your male and your female servants and the Levite who doesn't have any family, and the stranger and the orphan and the widow who are in your towns, 7 days you shall celebrate a feast of the Lord your God in the place which I'll choose for you. Wherever you are, I'll take you like out into the country, away from your regular place in the city. Because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and all the work of your hands so that you, and here's a goal, that you would be altogether, completely, fully, to the final sinew extent, altogether joyful. That you would experience joy beyond measure that you've ever known. 3 times a year, we're going to do these celebrations. Now remember, the event is usually a pretext, to some degree, for a much bigger deal. See, I mean, we want you to remember that your family, that your relatives lived in tents, and that God protected them. All right, couldn't we just send out a memo? Couldn't we just like maybe just share that for an afternoon or something? Let's just remember today, as you're walking around, that your ancestors lived in tents. All right. But a week? And then you want us to live in something like that? What are we supposed to be bummed out for a week with some more religious ceremony? No. Not if the desired outcome is 1615 of altogether joy. There's something bigger behind what I'm asking you than just remembering that you lived in tents. And not if the desired outcome is the adding of another thread to this fabric. I want them to experience that I am the Lord your God. So I want you to see how God initiates tradition and how beautifully he lays it out and how wonderfully he designs the very things inside me that on those summer days, laying in the grass while the sun was setting, I was having with my friends and I didn't know what to do with. First of all, if you start in Leviticus, there's an exact time. Okay, every year we do it here. We do it this day. This is when we do it. So it's on the 7th month, the 15th day of the 7th month. And after you've been working for a season hard together, in their case, they were all bringing in the harvest. And for us, we've been ministering together. I think of the food bank, and I think of us giving to that Christmas tree for kids in town. I think of the socks on the street. I think of all the stuff that we've been doing in this community, of all the people that we want to stand with, all the things that this place represents, all the classes that have been taught, all of the living together, all of the living real groups, all of the ministering together that this family has the privilege of getting to do. He says, in the context of that, I want this to happen. And I want there to be time off. Verse 39 says, no work. You're not doing any work for a week. All your regular stuff, don't do it. And I want you to come with everybody that means something to you. And so they're all brought together. You're rejoicing with family and friends and servants and strangers and orphans and widows. And the Levites. And verse 41 says, every single year we do this together. Every year. Promise? Swear on a stack of Bibles? And it will be not a heavy, dark, weird, strange time that your kids can't relate to. It will be absolute celebration. You'll hear it's called festival, feast. It's a time of play, of relaxation, of delight. I don't know if it's worth mentioning in chapter 16 that the celebration corresponded to the ingathering of the wine. I don't know. Is that coincidence? I wonder. And then there's this fun pretext. You're going to make booths. Silly, crude, fun, beautiful booths out in the wilderness. I'm going to take you away from town, and I'm going to take you where I will prescribe, and you'll go out there, and each family, and the stranger that you brought with them, and the Levite that you brought with them, and the alien that you brought with them, and your family, all of you are going to put together your best version of a booth. And they're going to look so funny. And you'll get to wander around and look at each other's. And so the pretext creates this beautiful event. And then in the middle of it, I want there to be incredible intentionality, sacred, God-centered representation of never forgetting that you're free people who used to be in slavery. And so what's so cool is he planned the remission of debt. Remember that happens in Israel every 7 years? He planned it for the shindig. He said, at one night, I want you to get together around a fire, bunch of fires, and I want the entire group of Israel to be involved in this remission of debt. It's talked about, you don't have to turn there, but it's talked about in Deuteronomy 31:10, where he says, Moses commanded them, saying, at the end of every 7 years, at the time of the year of remission of debts, it will happen at the Feast of Booths. And then in 15:1-2, he says, at the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a remission of debt. This is the manner of remission. Every creditor shall release what he has loaned to his neighbor. It'd be a good time, like the day before, to borrow something, you know. He shall not exact it of his neighbor and his brother, because the Lord's remission has been proclaimed. Can you imagine the power? All of you, all of Israel now. There's nobody in their isolated little worlds now. We're all together with all of our pain, with all of our hurt, with all of our issues, with all the stuff that we've caused each other. But now we're forced all to be together. And there's all sorts of hurt, and there's all sorts of frustration, and there's all sorts of lingering, festering wounds and that happen by a community being together long enough. And I imagine the heads of the household, one by one, calling out, Josiah, Josiah, Ben Abraham. And Josiah, Ben Abraham, would walk forward, and the father with his children and his wife and the servants and his whole clan standing around, he would say, you are free, my friend. You're welcome in my family. I have nothing over you. At all. We were all slaves, and you are my kin, and what is mine is yours, and you're forgiven your debt. And I imagine them holding each other in front of that whole audience with your family right next to you, and they're sobbing and weeping and restoration and healing and freeing. All that taking place in this beautiful week. Meaningful, silly, tender, with long enough time for it to be real, with three goals. One, that we would be altogether joyful, that we would get to experience what life in Christ and God feels like, that we would know a joy that transcends circumstances. Second goal is to transfer ownership of this way of life and these convictions to the next generation, so that they would see it and they'd go, whew, wherever I get lost or messed up, this is home. Wherever this thing doesn't make sense, whenever I get off track, this I remember. I remember my dad and my clan standing up there forgiving that man. I remember us laying around at night, looking through the slats of those palm and myrtle and olive branches, looking up at the stars, and I was laying right next to the servant. I was laying next to my mom and my dad and the stranger and the Levite. I want this life. I want this life. And third, that we would together experience that Yahweh, you are the Lord our God. And this is what it feels like to be the people of God. It's real and it's true and it's healing and it's strong, and you are in the center of it. You are the host of it. Man, I just picture that. All these out in the countryside, all these booths, and right nearby are piles and stacks of these harvested fruit and vegetables and jugs and vases full of this wine. The aroma of dates and currants. And then you've just got a week, so you're strolling through these lanes of these houses, of these booths, and it's silly, and you're making fun of some. I can't believe he would try to do a two-story one. That's not going to work. And people saying, come on over, you guys. Come on over, which they would never maybe do at any other time. And then fires maybe lit out in front of the booths and people sitting around together who have just missed seeing each other and being with each other. And then you could hear conversations 10, 15, 20 booths down as you were laying under the stars, falling asleep. It told them you're part of something bigger than just you. It told them you and your parents are part of something really wonderful. Don't ever miss this. This can be here for your whole lifetime. You'll find yourselves drawn closer to each other. You'll find it harder to run from each other or find a reason to not let another love you when they've hurt you. And you'll fully get to enjoy this life, this God life that I've given you. Remember who the creator of this event was? Oh, it's Yahweh. This was not a man-made event. This was Yahweh's event. It told them, I am amongst you. And no matter what you've done, no matter what trouble you've gotten into, no matter how much debt you owe, you, my friend, are in the center of it and you are right on time. There's a place, and I'm not sure, I can't remember where it was, Oak Harbor maybe, on Martha's Vineyard. We've had the privilege of getting to be there twice now and one time with our family, and we just stumbled upon it. I think it's Oak Harbor. And it blew us away. These lanes, lane after lane after lane of these like gingerbread houses. They used to be lean-tos, and the community is over 100 years old. And it comes to life. Some people live there year-round, but mostly it's for the summer. And some people would come for a week or 2 weeks. And it was totally started as a Christian event, and still is. And people show up and there's this giant amphitheater, kind of covered amphitheater in the middle where maybe 2,000-3,000 people could come together and they would come together to hear the word and to worship, and to sing out. And then they stayed in these little lanes. And they would go for a week or 2 weeks or a month or the entire summer. And they were known for having these lanterns. They still do it now. You go back to Martha's Vineyard in the summer, and you'll experience that, them taking these lanterns and going around house to house. Hey, come on over. People sitting out on their porches. We got something to eat. Phew. That sounds like heaven to me. Strong with your kids and people who love you, who trust this same God as you do. And people who maybe don't yet know him getting to watch and see it modeled out. And people taking time to say, I have not talked to you. I've wanted to say for a long time, I hurt you. And then we go stroll together carrying lanterns next to each other. So why? To remember commitments of love to each other. That they are the most important thing. It's what the world sees. To discover, to take the time to discover that each of us is walking this heroic, courageous walk. And for you to hear my story and believe me and not let me be alone. To have enough time to to be able to talk about something more than sports or shopping, to be able to get past that, to play, to laugh, to enjoy this life, to be able to understand that I did not come to God to have life be more miserable, but much more joyful. To let outsiders in so they could see and enjoy this life being modeled, to have something so fun that your kids would be the ones who would say, we have to do this next year. To sleep together under the stars outside of our normal routine. To learn how to live together when we aren't working. To release, to forgive, to repent, to heal. To give compassion, to receive compassion. To come home. To build a tapestry of a life that would keep me from running and wouldn't let me stay running. To discover what it means in my fibers, in my beings, through life experience with you, what it means that Yahweh is the Lord my God. As messed up as they were and as fragile as they were in the early days of Open Door, somehow they understood this. They understood to create goofy, playful times together as an excuse to get to love each other, to be altogether joyful, so that they would together experience the beauty of the Lord God in their midst. They worked hard. They shared the gospel to this entire city and beyond. This little funky group of people were so intentional in sharing who Jesus was. It was all in that hippie generation. They worked hard. They would have work days together. They would do stuff together. So the context for their lives was ministering to each other, not just showing up for events of a service or something that where I would be getting taken care of. They loved to be together in the context of doing ministry. And then after that, after a hand-in-hand or some of their hardest working together, they would go on picnics together. Gosh, they called a lot of picnics. Their picnics all the stinking time. Three-legged races and silly things that to just watch people make fools of themselves. And their work days. Whole church retreats where the entire church, there wouldn't even be the church, would just have a sign on that says, we're not here. And they would go to Mount Eldon or Prescott Pines, and they'd have a whole church retreat. And there were celebration Sundays. And the singles talent shows that finally were just shut down because they were just inappropriate. There were Valentine dances. There were these music concerts where neighbors and strangers were invited just to be there. So how could you, why would you, how could you not continue in such life-giving intentionality for the rest of your life? Well, I don't know, but we do. Sometimes it's for all the right reasons. We have children, our life changes. Our permissions. We're not just teenagers who can now go hang out at Manuel's and just hang out till late at night. We have children and they have sport events and they have different stuff from their schools, and gradually the fiber kind of gets threadbare. But maybe worse, sometimes we pull back because we got hurt or we failed. Or we just stop trusting because some of the people that made sense are no longer there anymore. And that now everything looks different. And that thing that allowed me to so carefreely enter in and play and create those traditions, it just doesn't feel there for me anymore. And then you politely give yourself an out. You pull away and you gradually drift from such occasions. You find other things to do. till one day you no longer feel part of it and you can't figure out why. And you feel embarrassed, so you check out. And you isolate, and you hide, or you create a new setting. And for me, when I did it, it felt like captivity. I felt like I was in a self-imposed captivity. You know, Israel went through that, right? Israel pulled back. Do you know that they said, hey, we promise, stack of Bibles, we promise we're going to do this forever. You know how long they did it? Less than a generation. Nehemiah says that before Joshua, the one following Moses, the one who brought them into the promised land, before he passed away, they had stopped doing it. They would occasionally do it every now and then during the times of Solomon and stuff, out of guilt, a rush of guilt. They would do it for a year or two, but by and large, after Joshua passed in the promised land, they stopped doing it. Did they stop because they went into captivity, or did they find themselves in captivity because they long ago had stopped? Fast forward through history. Fast forward, now they're in the promised land, and there's that period of Joshua, and then Judges, and then Samuel, and then they look for a king, and then there's Saul, and then there's David, and then there it goes on, and there's some... David dies and Solomon tries to be king, and then some bad brothers after that and some bad kings and a really twisted history that goes really south in a hurry, and then come the Assyrians and the Babylonians in captivity for 70 years. And the northern tribes are taken one place and the southern tribes are taken another place, and friends are separated from each other, and all these people have known each other and loved each other now scattered all over the world. And the next thing that you hear from Scripture is a man named Nehemiah, who's in a foreign land, who hears about the destruction of Jerusalem and all of its walls being burned, and he didn't know what to do. He just goes, I just have this heart. I barely know anything about Jerusalem, but I have this heart to see it rebuilt. This is my people. And there's this, you hear about Ezra, this priest, just this bedraggled group of people now who barely know what it is to be an Israelite. And they're kind of stumbling around in the rabble and the rubble of this ruin. And they find Ezra. He's the high priest, the best they got. And somebody finds the Scriptures. Somebody finds the law, the Pentateuch, the first five books. They can't believe it. They come across God's Word. And in fact, they stand up all day. They stand like this from sunrise to sunset just to hear it being read. Ah! Oh! They can't believe it. They're hearing from God for the first time. For some of them, they've never heard from God before. Some of the old ones are saying, I remember this. And then in the midst of it, one day they're reading and they say, listen to this, you guys. They used to go out into the fields and the hills and they made booths out of palm branches and olive branches and myrtle branches. It says that in Nehemiah. I love this. I love the book of Nehemiah. I love this story in here where he says, they found written in the law, 8:14, how the Lord had commanded through Moses that the sons of Israel should live in booths during the feast of the seventh month. So they proclaimed and circulated a proclamation, not just in Jerusalem, but all cities, saying, go out into the hills and bring olive branches and wild olive branches and myrtle branches and palm branches and branches of other leafy trees to make booths, as it's written. So the people, all of them, they came from all over, and they did it again. They brought them, and they made booths for themselves. Now, they're in the cities, and they're doing it on their roofs. and each on his own roof in the courts, and in the courts of the house of God, and the square at the water gate, and the square at the gate of Ephraim, all over the place, booths are built. These little scrawny, weird, crazy booths. The entire assembly of those who had returned from captivity made booths and they lived in them. The sons of Israel had indeed not done so from the days of Joshua, the son of Nun, to that day. Now listen, listen to what happened. What's the next words that are said? And there was great rejoicing again. God's people again inhabited this which he created for them. And they felt it again. They felt what it was like to be one of God's people together. Okay. I'm watching it happen again. The people who used to do this and then forgot it and went into captivity, I watched them remember. See, Open Door used to have a thing called Fellowship Weekend. We did it every year without fail. Shut down the church, go together, all of us. And then I don't know what happened. I don't know. I've rewritten history so many times, I have no idea what happened. I think we just got too big at first, but something else happened too. We gave ourselves permission to not find a way to do it. We just grew up. Our kids kids came and then, I don't know, but we stopped doing it. 3 years ago, some people who came to Open Door and got sick and tired of hearing our old stories, they said, we have read in documents that they used to go out into the countryside together and spend time together. And so what if we go for 7 days out of the mountains into a really, really terrible cabins, booths. So rudiment and so funky that there will be no heating, no cooling, and we'll take our kids. And we will rejoice, all together rejoice. And we will pass this on to our generation. And we will experience what it feels like to have our God as our Lord and God. And so the last 2 years, they have to close down the signups because it's what this generation says we have to do. By the way, they're all ages, this new generation that has come in that says, we want what you guys have. We want it now. So what events tell our kids who they are? Gosh, I was just at the Harvest Festival. Woo! Is that cool? All they needed was lanterns. You know, and we could have Martha's Vineyard. We could just do that. That was so great. I wanted it to be every night. What events do we maybe need to restore? It was so cool, even though it got rained out when the baker stood here. A family that's pretty new to Open Door and said, we'd like to kind of have the softball game thing. We've heard that you people do. And then what events do maybe we need to create to express who we are, that God's working in us? So all that to get now to the reason for this message. It's Christmas season, if you didn't notice. And God has afforded, in this particular culture, a prescribed season where some regular things are put on hold and some of us are given a little time off so we can find each other and Him in unusual, beautiful, ornate, playful, sacred events that don't happen any other time in the year. Now, I know many of us have this as our standard line to get through the season. I hate the commercialism of the season. Hate it. Can't stand it. I just wait for it to get over. Hate the commercialism of the season. Yeah, we all get that. We all get that. They've taken Christ out of Christmas. That's what they've done. They've taken Christ out of Christmas. Well, of course they have. They never wanted it. I don't know if you noticed, but the people all in the uniforms at Macy's, they're not deacons and deaconesses. They're salespeople. This culture wants Santa and some vague thing about peace on earth. What would you expect of them? They don't yet know him and are pretty sure from our yelling that maybe they don't want to. And they have the laws on their side. And God is not glorified in our pouting. Hey, this is our season. This is our season. So we get to find meaningful expressions that give pretext, that allow friends from the past and from the present, and some that we don't even know yet, to celebrate this life in Christ. So we figure out how we'd have maximum fun and then give our lives away and model the same for everybody else. Can I give you an observation? There is no other time than this season where I watch families feeling insecure. Isn't that crazy? A season celebrating the one who gave us our new identity can actually cause us to doubt our new identity and seek to find our worth in how well we pull off an ad man's version of Christmas. This season will try to suck you into a promise it cannot pull off. It'll put you on a hamster wheel of performance and leave you panting and ashamed that you couldn't pull off what the commercials paint. Can I just tell you something? I'm 58 now. I've been a Christian for a long time. And there's no party that I've been to that I couldn't have missed. Except Rice Night. I can't miss Rice Night. Guys, I got to tell you, there's no event that has made my life. We get to redeem this season. We get to intentionally choose. We get to be freed from thinking, are we missing out on something that's going to scar us and our children? What if we're home one evening and not doing something? Like maybe look at the decorations you put up to enjoy. What if that evening when you were just home, maybe intentionally and simply and naturally lived out might be the very best evening? See, we get to allow God to create our best Christmas season. And nobody anywhere can do that better than you. And you can pull it off. And you can invite people that you've never thought of inviting. And you can create your own. For us, we have so many traditions. We just love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. The most recent one for us is the granola pancake trip in our pajamas up to Payson. And it's just four or five of us, whatever can fit in one car. Kaylee has kept a tradition alive. And we just go up to the Beeline Cafe in Payson, and we have granola pancakes, because they have them there. Nobody likes them, but it's what we do. It's a tradition. The other one is Gnome Night. Gnome Night, the sacred night, it started with Mike Shapiro giving us for Christmas a book on gnomes. And then we invited a few people to be gnomes and dress up. And we dress up in crazy gnome outfits and we look ridiculous. We take a picture and we laugh and play and then we go to visit some people who are in the hospital or not feeling well or alone because their spouse passed away or whatever. And we take little trinkets and fun things and we pray with them and we hang out with them. It's one of my favorite whole times of the year. And anybody, by the way, if you're visited because you're sick or you're not feeling good, you automatically become a gnome and you can do it next year for other people. We get to meet him in this season, you guys. And he has created tradition as the pretext that gives us that permission. It is beautiful. Even this week, Stacy and I have learned as our life changes, we ride our bikes up for the Christmas boutique. John Rhodes makes tacos and Gabe Rosania has salsa. That's all I know that happens. And then, that's this weekend, and then also this weekend, Friday and Saturday night, is the Randy Thompson concert. That's a beautiful, beautiful tradition. We're shoulder to shoulder with people that you love. And then there's Christmas Eve cantata, and this year, Christmas morning with buttermilk donuts, a new tradition. And I know you're thinking, you don't understand, John, we're not in a very good place right now. We're hurting. And I go, great. It is a perfect time to start some traditions because you need threads to create a garment of love. A healing garment of love. Oh, you want to know the best tradition of all? It's one that we do here every week. This is a tradition. It's interesting. The very best tradition doesn't have to have a day or a date associated to it. Do you know that this doesn't have to happen just here? This taking of the bread and cup, it doesn't have to happen just here. And you think, well, don't you have to have an elder presiding over it? No. Well, doesn't it have to be a man? No. Doesn't it have to be in a church? No. Doesn't it have to have those dry wafers and the juice? No. You could celebrate the life and death and burial and resurrection and joy of Jesus Christ as you're out looking at Christmas lights with your kids. This one, he says, wherever you are, wherever you're gathering, remember me. All the time, in any setting. This is the sweetest of all of them. You know my favorite place to share it? My favorite place to experience it? And I don't get to do it much anymore, is passing it out amongst you in this room with this sweet brother, group of brothers and sisters. I love it more than anything I can get to do. I love it more than anything I can get to do. Guys, we're about to go into it. So with all of our pain and with all of our hurt, let's go into this incredible tradition.